Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Dee Norman is a witch who grew up in her family's Italian-American magical tradition and is the author of Burn a Black Candle, an Italian-American grimoire. And she contributed to Llewellyn's complete book of North American folk magic. She has been a student of cartomancy since the mid-80s and is the creator of the Emblemata Lenormand, one of those words I can't say, Lenormand, Oracle deck. She is also a card reader with clients around the globe. Throughout the past 20 years, she has been using her professional experience as an adult educator to develop and present workshops on tarot, Lenormand, and a variety of magical topics. When not tending her household altar or paging through grimoires, she likes to play creepy video games and explore amateur cryptography with her daughter. Find out more about her projects and read her blog at blackcandlecottage.com. Dee Norman, welcome to Witchlit.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I am excited to talk Italian American magic with you. But before we get to that, our first question for everybody on the show is, why write?
Because of my lifelong love affair with books. I talk a little bit about in the beginning of Burn a Black Candle. As a child, if I had a question or didn't know something and I'd ask my father, he would say, well, let's go check it out at the library. We'd get on our bikes, we'd ride to the local branch of the library, and he would help me learn how to use the library, look up the answer. And that fostered a very early love of books and all of the wonderful things that they can do. Particularly nonfiction books. So there's always been a dream of mine since I was little. It just took me this long to actually realize it.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know though. I see a lot of people who publish really young, and I published my first book when I was 44, 4 years past my deadline. I said I wanted to have a book before I was 40. And I think, in some ways, I don't know if that's true for you, like, waiting until I felt more confident in who I am as a person, I think was good.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I am a very anxious person. I try not to be. And I feel like even with how well I knew my subject matter for my first book and that I grew up with it, I had a lot of imposter syndrome to get over even in my late 40s. Mm-hmm. And I think if I had tried to do that in my 20s or 30s, I have a great admiration for people who are confident enough to write that young, but I don't think I ever would have completed the project if I had started it that early. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I am an anxious person, so I feel you on that. And I think even, like you said, even though I felt more comfortable, and I write fiction, so that's kind of a different, I still had a lot of imposter syndrome because I had this academic background in creative writing. And it was like, oh, I'm writing genre fiction. Is this really writing? You know, like the whole shebang of garbage. So yeah, I think, but I do admire people, like you said, who come out of the gate a lot earlier and with more confidence, like yay team.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the thing that finally pushed you to write the book?
Ironically, so my partner and I had been discussing starting a podcast, which we still have not done. And I was prepping for that, and we were having a really busy time in our life. And so we couldn't really get around to it. And I thought, well, I've got all this energy built up to do something creative. What can I do? And I was like, well, it's easy to sit down by yourself and write without like equipment and without having to have someone else participate and stuff like that. So I started and I wrote a very short, kind of sparse draft. And then a few years later, the pandemic happened. And I went, what can I do to occupy myself? And you'll see very early on posts on my Instagram talking about everybody stay home. And this is what I'm doing to stay home. I'm working on this draft of this book. So that's what started to make me have a little bit more, pay a little bit more attention to it, take it more seriously. So that's what gave me the opening to do it.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of pandemic books too. I think we just kind of all like, oh, if we're going to be home, let's do something productive.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I also had like the beginning of the pandemic, a super creative last half of the pandemic. Well, I guess the last half, the first chunk, and we're still in it. I mean, who knows? But yeah, I hit a wall at some point too. So, funnily enough, I talked to a lot of Llewellyn writers on the show because, you know, that's where a lot of witchy books get published. And obviously you contributed to the North American folk magic book, but you published Burn a Black Candle with Watkins, and I'm kind of like, Watkins is storied, obviously. So I'm kind of curious how all that came about. How did you end up at Watkins?
It's kind of crazy. So I, if we wind it back a little bit, my complete love of books translated very early on into collecting books on esoteric and magical topics. And I have a big old collection of that. And I love all of the publishers, including especially Llewellyn. They were like the publisher for me when I was a kid. But Watkins is also historically significant as an esoteric publisher. And because of the pandemic, there was this audio app that I got way into called Clubhouse. And I started a little club called Occult Observatory. And through it, I met the woman that would become my agent. And I hired her at first to be book coach because I got to the point in my manuscript, I'm like, I just don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I needed a coach. And I liked the way she had experience writing in the spirituality, metaphysical publishing industry. And so I asked her to be my coach. And partway through the coach, she said, okay, I want to make the offer to become your agent because I think this book can go somewhere. I think that someone could pick it up for traditional publishing. And I was flabbergasted because I always had this vision that this was going to be my little indie hand lettered chap book that I was going to self publish and maybe sell 100 copies. And my daughter would have a copy to have, you know, this is the book my crazy mother mm-hmm. wrote. And I didn't know what to do about it. I was so excited about it, but I didn't know what to do. And so I thought about it and I came back and I said, okay, let's do it. Like, how can I pass up this opportunity if someone wants to represent this? And Watkins was my book coach and a later agent. She's from the UK lives in the UK. And Watkins is a UK publisher. So it was one of the first publishers she thought to go to. Of the three publishers that we first pitched to, they were one of the first and they picked it up really fast, shockingly fast. And I sat in my room and cried for about 2 hours because I just had this huge emotional release when I found out because none of it seemed real. Mm-hmm. Historically, Watkins is a company that was started because Madame Blavatsky said to a friend in London, it's really terrible that there are no occult bookshops in London. And so her friend started this bookshop and it became a publishing house. And so mm-hmm. that's a heck of a pedigree for a esoteric publisher.
Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. And I just felt like, and Watkins also does, I mean, like you said, like Llewellyn is definitely the publisher of my early exposure to witchcraft books. And I think they still publish, you know, amazing books every year, but it is really interesting to me the whole, like, there's so many little publishers in the UK that have these really interesting stories and are publishing really interesting books. And so, yeah, I was just like, oh, get to talk about Watkins. Cool. I have actually been once when I was in London, I got to go and stand in the store. So
I've never been to London. I have never set foot anywhere near Watkins. One day I would absolutely love to.
Yeah.
But
I highly recommend, especially book nerds. London is, I mean, it's not like the book mecca it used to be, like, you know, but there's still just so many great bookstores. And although the one thing I get, because I was a, you know, I did a creative writing degree, I have a degree in English, and I'd read so many books that in all periods of London, right? And so when I got to London, I was like, oh, I know. It's nothing like what I imagined, because I imagined the city of London is like everything very central.
Oh.
And it is, but it's along the river. So what things that I thought were really close to each other are actually really far apart because they're in different parts of the river. It was like, it totally rearranged my mental map to actually be there. So, but I do recommend it.
I will put that on the list of things to do.
Yeah, really. And it's great. So one of the things that shows up a lot in the book, and I love this because I think it's one of those things that kind of goes to some level of universality in a lot of human experience, but like the conversation with your mom and grandmother early on, where they kind of shoo you out of the room and don't really tell you. Like, I feel like this is like the human experience of children. So what was the thing that finally they were like, okay, you're prepared to get this knowledge? Like, when did that shift?
Well, you know, it's funny because I remember a particular watershed moment. It was very late in my life. It was in my 30s, really. You know, and throughout my childhood, I had observed a bunch of stuff. I had noticed a bunch of stuff. And every now and then my mother would say, like, you know, that I talk about taking a piece of hay from the manger on Christmas Eve and putting it in your wallet all year long so you have money. I'd watch her do it. She'd tell me to do it and why we were doing it for money in the pocket. But like, there would be no recognition of what we're doing, or, you know, not no acknowledgement of it. And so I collected all of this stuff, and it was all stuff that I would do. And then I went, and I think this helped. I moved out of the country for a few years. I moved to Australia and lived in Australia for 6 years. When I came back for a visit once, we were sitting around my family's dining room table, and I have a friend of mine who has been involved in magic and esoteric stuff for years. And he had asked me a detail about one of my family practices, because I said, I'll ask my mother and grandmother and see what they say. And I use it as an excuse to like openly bring it up and say, hey guys, why do we do this? What does this do? And they were like, you really want to know? And I was like, yeah, I do. Because in their opinion, they don't do that official fancy magic that I do when I do ceremonial magic, or, you know, either, you know, other types of magic. It's nothing important what they're doing in a way. Mm-hmm. I said, yes, really want to know. And so they sat down, and I have the notes still that I took on that afternoon, frantically writing down, this is what we did for this. This is what we did for that. This is what we did. And my grandmother just spilled it. And I don't know if it was because I had been gone and they missed me. I don't know if it was because I was of an age. I don't know if I had finally asked enough time. I wish I could go back and ask my grandmother.
Why?
Why because then? It was very funny. She was reiterating how to do, you know, the infamous evil eye cure with oil and water. And my mom stopped her in the middle. She's like, wait, you never told me to do this one step. My grandmother's like, yeah, you do this step. And they got in an argument over how it was done right. And why didn't grandma tell mom all these years that it was done? Yeah, it was really funny. But it was also so exciting. I couldn't believe it was happening when it happened, that they were finally willing to sit down and have a just very direct conversation about it. And I was probably 33, 34.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. Like when that door opens, when they're like, oh no, you could stay. Like it's a whole different thing. I mean, my family on my mom's side is Appalachian. And so there were lots of little things like that. And same, never would have called it magic. Never, you know, it's just stuff you do. Superstitious. Sometimes they would be superstitious. But yeah. So I'm curious, like, because this is a family tradition, and I think, and it probably goes back to thinking about like the early 90s, and everybody was like, oh, I'm a traditional witch, you know, like family. You know, tried family witch, whatever. It's like, yeah, we can't all be. but I do think about like a lot of people don't like to share those, who really do have those things, don't like to share them, or their family doesn't want them to share them. So was there any like friction about publishing a book, or what was that kind of conversation like?
It's so great. I'm sitting here shaking my head at you. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, no, no. I know.
There's no friction. So I talk about this a lot too, because, you know, people talk about online a lot about open and closed practices, and is it okay for someone to pick a book like Burn a Black Candle that maybe isn't Italian and or Italian American, because that's different than Italian, and do these practices. And once that watershed moment happened, well, first of all, my grandmother would always love to sneakily give advice. So the friend that I talked about that had the question, his name is Chip, and she would sneakily give advice about, well, tell your friend to do this. And I would be like, why? And she'd be like, I don't know. It'll just help. Like, she would be very vague. My grandmother was hilarious. And Chip was not Italian. Either friends that were involved in esoteric community weren't Italian, but grandma was so thrilled that people were just interested in doing things that she could understand on some level, that she just shared openly. So it never occurred to me when I started writing the book that it might be a problem. And then when I got the offer and the publishing deal, I went to my mom and I'm like, this happened. And she was like, really? People want to know about that? And I'm like, yes. And she's like, that's fantastic. And she expressed no concern. Mm-hmm. And then when she finally got a copy of the book in her hand, she flipped through the contents and she's like, wow, you really got it all in here. And I said, is that okay? And she looked me dead in the eye. She said, I think that's wonderful.
Aww.
And I cried. She cried.
Yeah.
Everybody cried.
Yeah.
But a lot of this is going away because either that urge to have the children assimilate, so that they're part of the mainstream culture and we don't want to teach them anything that's going to make them stand out, or just nobody takes the interest to learn. And then later on in their life, they want to learn, but grandma and mom are already passed. And so I wanted to somehow give people who are interested in this to learn about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as my mother and grandmother, they always had the door open to my friends who were interested in esoteric stuff, to at least lend an understanding ear and give some advice. And they never said, well, don't tell your friends how to do this. It was always like, well, why don't you tell them to go burn a black candle in their house if they're feeling uncomfortable or, you know, having trouble with their boss or whatever. So I took the lead of my mother and grandmother in that, and didn't. None of us really concerned ourselves with what background everybody's welcome at the table.
Yeah. I think like reading through the book, there's so many things that like, oh, there's like an Appalachian take on the same idea, you know, like there's just things like that. And I think that that's true for a lot of practice, at least, you know, in North America, which shows up in the lovely book from Llewellyn about North American folk magic. There are similarities across a lot of different things that have arisen in their own cultural context. But I recently saw a presentation about like German folklore. And despite the folkish branch of German folklore people and practitioners who will not be part of this conversation, German folklore is kind of open to everybody. Germany wasn't an entity. Like, it was a bunch of little kingdoms. And so in like Italy, you know, there was each kind of place had its own thing. Like, my family is from Pomerania, which is now in Poland. It's not even part of Germany anymore, you know, like, so it's interesting to me that those things, and especially them brought to, you know, with colonization and settling, brought to North America, and how they get mixed in. And like, if your family intermarries with somebody, then you've got like German Italian magic going on or whatever. So.
My, one of my most treasured possessions from my grandmother is a pendant. And, I used to be fascinated with it when I was a child. And I thought she wore it because my dad had a coin collection. And no, it was my grandmother regularly wore a silver mercury head dime around her neck. And that is a famous, famous practice in African-American folk magic as a protection thing to let you know if anything got thrown your way. And later on, you know, talking to my grandmother about her life, she lived beneath on the first floor, and an African-American family lived on the second floor when she was raising her children, and she was BFFs with the lady upstairs. And I'm like, oh. So to me, that is like illustrative of mm-hmm. one of those amazing mixing pot examples yeah. where, you know, I've fascinated by that necklace all my life. I have it now and I wear it all the time. But it doesn't come from Italian American culture. But it was something grandma understood and identified immediately mm-hmm. as a practice that made sense to her. And she adopted it and did it all her life.
Yeah. And like a hoodoo conjure African-American practice with U.S. money, with U.S. currency. So again, right. this kind of like, you know, using the local thing at hand for magic you might have done another way. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. No, I'm fascinated by stuff like that. And I think about, like the title of your book is the subtitle is an Italian American grimoire. And I thought about like grimoire was an interesting choice, I think, because it really is writing down what has been an oral tradition. It is, like you said, it's saving this from disappearing, which I thought was, did you have a hand in that or was that strictly on the publisher?
That was all me. That was all me. Think Watkins, because I initially named it just an Italian-American grimoire because I didn't know what to name it mm-hmm. and thought that that was its working title. But I love the term grimoire and what it stands for. And I love the close relationship grimoires have sometimes with household books mm-hmm. from the Middle Ages, which, you know, were books on how to run the household, but then you'll find here's a prayer to Saint Michael to cure fever, and here's how to find a thief using bibliomancy, and so household books sometimes contain magical and medico-magical data and information because you need that to run your household because there's no hard line drawn between those two mm-hmm. things. And so when I sat down and thought about everything that my mother and grandmother did, most everything is about raising your family or running your household in this book. And so I thought, I won't call it a household book because that's kind of crazy and no one will know what I'm talking about. But I really do think that this can count as a grimoire, not as it presents an entire organized system of magic, but here is a collection of oral practices that we're getting down on paper. And all grimoire means in modern language is a book of magic. And so mm-hmm. I think, well, that counts. So yeah. they... asked for a more poetic title and allowed me to keep that as a subtitle. And I was very nice. Happy.
Yeah. Well, Burn a Bell and Candle Works is a great, I mean, it's such a great title.
Yeah.
Well, and I think my personal magic has a black candle involved, not for Italian American reasons, just, and so I was like, again, these little touch points between different things. I was like, oh, I don't know. I love this. And also I'm a grimoire geek. So. I just got David Rankin's new Encyclopedia of Grimoires in paperback. I just want to say I did not pre-order the leather-bound one, but I got the paperback. And it is, I have been lost for days, just like thumbing through. So highly recommend.
I will check it out.
Yeah. It's, yeah, the second volume is just appendices of lists. Like it is a book nerd dream.
I'm salivating. Okay. And what's the full title again?
I can show. Unfortunately, listeners will not be able to see this, but it is the Grimoire Encyclopedia in two volumes. And they're like, this is volume two. So, and volume one is the same size.
I need that.
Yeah. No, it is. And I listened to an interview. Like, I would love to get him on the show, but I listened to an interview with him. And we're talking about somebody else's book, not yours. Sorry.
But, that's all right.
But yeah, he was just talking about the research he did to do this book because a lot of these grimoires he's talking about aren't even translated into English.
So. Yes. Yes. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So highly recommend for grimoire book nerds. So.
Yay.
Yeah. So I guess I don't know, we can get this out if this isn't okay, but you are working on a new project that might touch on this. You want to talk about that a little
bit? Yes. So I have, before Burn a Black Candle came out, I came out with a Lenormand deck called the Emblemata Lenormand. And speaking of being a book nerd, all of the art and imagery in the deck is based on emblem books from the 16th century, one in particular. And I kind of released it independently, so it's available on Etsy. And I had many people say, well, when are you writing the guidebook for this? And I said, well, you know, I got this contract to write this book called Burn a Black Candle. So after that, sometime. And let me just say, it is much easier to write a manuscript and hand it to a publisher, and they handle everything, the design and the cover and all of that. And isn't that lovely? But independently publishing a book was hard. So just now, I have finished the final revision for Secret Symbols, a guide to the Emblemata Lenormand. And that is, it will be available in paperback in October. There is a kind of testing how Kindle KDP works ebook version available on Amazon right now, but it's kind of not officially released. I'm just kind of tinkering around with it because this is the first time I've tried to independently publish something, but it's a full guide to the symbolism and how to specifically use my Emblemata Lenormand oracle deck.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Lenormand is, I have a deck. I have played with it a couple times, but it's so different that I just haven't like sat down and really looked at like the full spread and like the, it's just such a different experience than tarot or oracle cards or anything else.
I think that for people who are tarot readers, practicing and playing around with Lenormand can really help inform and build your tarot skill set and vice versa. For people who, sometimes people struggle in tarot to build a coherent story with multiple cards and to build, you know, a concept that's coming, what the cards are saying when they come in multiples. With Lenormand, you always work with it more than one card. You at least work with two or more, and you literally build a coherent sentence based on one card after the other, and what they're telling you. And I think that that is a fun, you know, Lenormand's 36 cards. You got these easy keywords to remember, and you can play around with that concept in a very stripped down manner. And then take that skill that you built back to tarot and its complexities. So I am always like trying to push Lenormand on fellow tarot readers. Say, you know, if you want to practice your, you know, that card combination story building that so many people seem to struggle with or want to enhance their skill set with, Lenormand is an amazing opportunity to do that. And it takes away the baggage of tarot.
Mm-hmm.
And gives you like a new playground to develop that skill in.
Maybe it sounds like I need to give it another shot. I really like oracle cards for the same reason, because you can do that kind of story with simpler images. I think I need to give it another shot. Sounds like, so now I'll have a guide to do it. Yeah, self-publishing is really different than traditional publishing. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Like what the struggles have been for you with self-publishing? I feel like people always kind of think it's like you just push publish and it doesn't work that way.
It was, to me, it always was based on like, I can write the manuscript, but now here's the tools I have to learn to do everything else. So what tool do I use to prepare it to be converted into an ebook or into a paperback book and do the interior book design? You know, and do I try to struggle with a word template or do I use a tool like Atticus? Both have a learning curve, which has a shallower learning curve.
Yeah.
You know, when I need to build a cover, you know, am I going to mess around with learning a tool to build the cover, and all the back copy and get all the lettering and fonts right? Or am I going to just hire somebody, and, you know, having to try to figure out all of that was like the last 6 months of this little shindig of getting this together, because I was doing it for the first time. And it always takes you longer the first time you do mm-hmm. something like that.
But definitely.
Then with publishing, traditionally, though, you really take your hands off the wheel. So instead of getting to control all of that, you just have to tell yourself, well, now they bought it, they're going to do with it what they want.
Yeah.
And I had some input on what the cover looked like for my book, but not a ton. I was thrilled the moment I saw my cover, by the way. I really liked it. I got approval on the interior design, but I'm sure that they wouldn't have allowed major changes. So I'm happy that they treated my book with such consideration and care, especially for a first-time author, and really put a lot into it. But I didn't have, I'm like, oh my, I think my movie book's just taken on a life of its own. So for folks who are considering which way to go, you have to weigh those pros and cons of either not having to learn how to also be a cover designer and a typesetter and a formatter and an interior designer, but giving up all control or having control of every little detail about your book, but then having to take on that learning curve and learn multiple skill sets to really do a professional looking job.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the professional looking job part of it is really the kicker there, because you can just push publish, but it's not going to look great.
Yeah.
And if you're doing it yourself and you decide to bring in professionals, then that, how many books you sell to break even number changes.
Yes.
Drastically. Yes. So yeah, it's definitely a different thing. And I know I looked out, and the first publisher I went with was kind of like a hybrid. Like, I did a little bit myself and they did some stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when they reorganized, I got all the rights back to my books, and we're like, well, let's just start our own publishing house. And my husband, bless him, had worked for Ingram. He worked for them when they started Lightning Source, and they were transferring all these books from, you know, some of them out of print to print on demand. So he had a background in that, and he's a graphic designer, so he could do covers. So like the most expensive parts I got to do in-house. I do pay an editor because I cannot edit my own stuff. I admire anybody who can do that. I can't do it.
When it comes to secret symbols, can I just give a gigantic shout out to my friend Molly, who is a pup. She is a sci-fi fantasy author. She's brilliant and she's awesome at editing. And so she, bless her, we trade back and forth editing and reading and reviewing services.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
She did all my editing for Secret Symbols. So I very much lucked out there, because I think that editing is the key for if you're doing indie publishing. You got to get eyes on it and experienced eyes on your manuscript, so that you don't, to make it look professional and to give your readers a good experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, it's one of the things, like, as a writer, you know what you meant on the page. And so when you read it later, you're still adding that information that may not actually be there. And I think just having, you know, a line editor, a proofreader, if you can do all of that, that's amazing. So I rely on other writer friends to kind of be line editor, beta readers, and then I pay a proofer. So
it's one thing that I have very much enjoyed. My sister-in-law, her name is Paige Christie, and she has a whole series of sci-fi fantasy novels about cowboys and dragons on another planet, believe it or not. Through her, I have met a ton of other writers, and building that community and having other writers you can go to for advice or for help or for, hey, can you look at this, is so, I didn't realize how important it is, because everyone talks about writing being a solitary pursuit, and it is. But then if you're going to try to get your work out there, that network of people that can support you and provide advice or help you find someone who can perform the service that you need is key, I think, to being a successful writer. And I hate networking, and I'm an introvert, but by God, I've learned to love it because of everything that it's done for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, writing groups, like, and I always tell people who are coming to writing, you know, either late in life or they're new, or, you know, whatever the reason is, like, find a writing group because it'll change your writing. I mean, I think it can. I think that there can be some pitfalls there too, depending on where everybody is in their writing career. Like that can sometimes be weird and a weird dynamic in a writing group. But if you find the right people, it gets life changing as a writer to have those folks. And I mean, most of my like close writing friends are romance writers, but they've got the goods. I mean, they know how to sell books. They know how to edit and write quickly. I mean, they're just like, they're on a different level. And thankfully, you know, romance books support the rest of publishing. So bless them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Someday I have a goal to write a romance novel, but every time I sit down to do one, I murder somebody too quickly. And it just
And I want to do a paranormal romance. He's hilarious. I'm like, this is going to turn into a paranormal romance comedy if we do it. But like,
I will read them. Bring it on. Bring it on. Bring it on. Bring it on. So one of the things I do think is interesting about nonfiction writing, and I'm in the middle of a nonfiction project right now, so I've been thinking about this a lot and asking lots of people about it. Like, research-wise, it sounds like for the Lena Run deck and your other upcoming project, like there's a lot more research probably than on the first book, because the first book is so much from your own family experience. So what is your approach to that? Like, it's just so easy if you're already a book nerd to just go down a rabbit hole and never come up for air. So how do you kind of navigate researching for this project?
I don't. exposed. Yes, Black Candle, it was a breeze because it was stuff my family was doing. I had very little to confirm or fact checking or anything like that. You know, I've got another project that I'm working on that is about grimoires, but it's going to take a while for it to come out. And I am a hand note taker. I cannot think through but I'm not a note card person. So like, I don't know if you remember school and they like you had the note card for your sources and you had a source card and then you had a card for each quote or concept from each book and they corresponded. I love that idea. I cannot do it. It doesn't work for me.
No.
So I have my little, I have a notebook per book that I'm working on that's nonfiction. And I use it to keep a running list of things I am curious about that I think will fall into the book somewhere. And then I will number code that little curiosity statement with the research that I have done, both my findings and the sources that I have found it in. Mm-hmm. On the subsequent pages of the book. And then I use a whole lot of highlighting and scribbling and multicolored pens and post-it notes to do that. And it sounds messy, but to me, it is very aesthetically pleasing to work with the information in such a physical way. And I have tried, I have an iPad, these beautiful apps like Bear and other note-taking apps that help you do all kinds of idea connection and stuff. No, I want my paper and my pens and my highlighters and my sticky notes. And I want to go to town with that and my physical books. I'm terrible. I love eBooks for fiction, but if I'm doing research, I want a physical book in my hands. And so I do it that way.
Yeah.
That is a messy answer.
but I think a real one. And I'm the same way. Like, I remember like the note card approach we were taught in school. I don't even know if they still teach people to do that, but like, I remember reading this thing about, what's her name? Elizabeth, the Eat, Pray, Love author. What is her name?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Writing her book about, the scientist and like book or shoeboxes full of note cards. And I was like, I would lose my mind. Like, my brain just does not work that way. Like, I mark up the books I'm reading. That's why I always get paperbacks, because I feel guilty writing in hardback books. Because I write, I highlight, I put sticky notes in, I put tabs in. Like, this is a book I'm using for research and it's got all the stuff in it. And then I, you know, got like margin notes to go look at this book over here. And because a lot of the research I'm doing right now, a lot of the books are out of print and I've been getting a lot of stuff from archive.org. And downloading PDFs, like I mark up the PDFs with my stylus on my iPad because I need to physically touch it, like you said, and highlight it and make a note. And that's the only way I could do it with the ebook is if I download it as a PDF. So bless archive.org for out of print PDFs and Gutenberg Project. Like, I don't know how I would have gotten access to some of this stuff without them. So, but yeah, it's, I was going to say is that no one would think mine was organized, but it's organized for me. So
yeah, as long as it works. And that's the thing. I think to people kept telling me when I started really trying to seriously write my first book, you know, as long as it works for you, it's fine, do it. And I had this skepticism in my head of, well, like, man, really, there's got to be like the most efficient, perfect way. Yeah, there is an efficient, perfect way, and it's whatever way works for you. As long as you're getting words down on paper, you're succeeding. So go for it.
I think you should underline that and put little stars next to it for the people in the back.
Right.
Like, it's just such important advice. I don't think there's universal writing, research, publishing advice. I just don't think it exists. Every book is different. Every project is different. Every writer is different.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who will take your money to sell you a golden shovel for that you will never see the return on.
Yes.
Buyer beware.
So, yes.
But yeah, it's interesting stuff. So what's something you're reading or researching now that's got you on fire?
Geez, let me think. Well, right now it's very interesting to me. My partner is working on a book on tarot, which I know there's a billion books on tarot out there, but he's skilled in memory techniques from like the Middle Ages, like memory palaces and other stuff like that.
Cool,
he's working on combining those two things so that he can write a book for folks saying, here's how you use memory techniques to memorize this huge amount of data on tarot so you can learn more about your deck and do better reading. This is causing me to go back and revisit all of these books on tarot that I haven't touched in years. So because we're talking about tarot every single day because he's doing his research for it. And he's like, what do you think about this book and that book? And I'm digging books out of our library. And we have a library of over 2,000 books. It's completely taken over our living room. And, you know, we're going through them and you know, looking for, you know, I'm pulling out A.E. Waite's The Pictorial Key to the Tarot. And I haven't touched that probably since I was 15 or 20 years old and going through it and going, dear Lord, this makes no sense. Don't look at this one. But it's so much fun to go back and revisit books that I have read as a youth. And now that I have had a lifetime kind of experience and going back and looking at it and truly evaluating it and going, yes, this is going to help you learn more about, you know, this topic, or no, it's not. Because when I was a kid, everything was great because I could hardly get a hold of anything, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It was different in the 80s and there wasn't as much access. So really the past couple of weeks, I have been buried up to my chin in old tarot books that came out years ago as we look through a library. It's probably not the most fascinating answer, but.
No, but I think it really is. And one of the things I love about that experience, and same thing, like even when I was in school, like when you connect a piece of information to something else and you like see the bridge that already existed that you just got to walk across. I love that experience.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of any particular books we've like dove into like really deeply, but mostly we're just going through and evaluating and what books are he's going to use as reference tools for when he sits down and does his writing push. So
how do you all manage two writers in a house full of books? Like, how do you navigate that?
We don't. There's a reason why I thank him and say what I say in the acknowledgments in Burn a Black Candle. He put everything on hold so I could get that book done. He took over the entire household management and handling everything and gave me the space to write. And that is why now when he's put off writing this book for over a year, and now he is trying to get his act together and do it. And so I'm trying to shift gears and support the way he's supported, but also continue to meet all my obligations and other things that I need to write. So it's really, it's hard, and we're learning. It's a first for us, and we're learning how to do that too.
Yeah, especially with kids still at home. I mean, that's a whole different.
Yeah.
That's a whole different thing. Yeah. I didn't really pick up writing again. I mean, I had a blog and I did a lot of stuff before my son graduated, but I didn't really like hit it hard again until he was out of the house the first time. But yeah, I mean, and now I live in a house with a creative. I mean, my husband does graphic design and that kind of stuff. And then two of the writers, my son and his partner, both write. So it's like, you know, we're all of us are stuck in a book, stuck in a screen. It's we have a really detailed reminder list to keep the house clean, which I highly recommend to anybody who needs it. It is really helpful, except we all also have some obsessive compulsive tendencies. So when they turn red, we all freak out. Apple reminders has been our friend to make sure the toilets get scrubbed in the middle of writing.
We use a shared Apple note for things like, oh my God, groceries we need to order or go buy because we ran out of them, but we haven't used the reminder app yet. So we might jump into that.
Yeah,
it's
funny the things that help.
Highly praised teenagers that you can use for free labor. My beloved daughter and my partner's son, Theo, who is also beloved, they're getting to the age where they can autonomously go, oh, the dishes really need it. So they go and do the dishes, or, you know, if we ask them to do something, they're real proficient at doing it. So teaching them practical life skills, and I'm also getting to spend an extra 20 minutes on writing.
On something, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's the modern writer's thing, is how do you carve out the time? I mean, if you're not lucky enough to be able to write full time, like how do you make that happen when you have life and, you know, possibly a part-time or full-time job and, you know, all this other stuff on top of it? It's a challenge.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, we try to keep this to an hour. I'm not great about it. But before we get to our game of chance, I did want to give you an opportunity to plug what you got coming. Like I said, this will come out early November. And if you got any appearances or anything, where people can find you, where you want to be found.
Oh, geez. I'm so terrible at this. I should have like a rote thing. But I don't. So I am Black Candle Cottage nearly everywhere. I have a website that's www.blackcandlecottage.com. I am Black Candle Cottage on Etsy if you want to go check out the Emblemata Lanermond deck. I am in the process again of writing Secret Symbols, a Guide to the Emblemata Lanermond. It is floating around out there on Amazon as an ebook that is not 100% proofed and needs some updates. But that will be coming out in paperback probably in October of this year. And what else? If anybody is going to be in Atlanta, Georgia in October for Multiverse Convention, I'm a guest there. So I will be making an appearance there. And next week I will be in Michigan for Michigan Sisters in Crime, talking about what to do if you, you know, if you get a book deal, what's it like for the first time around, like a newbie's guide to negotiating, not actually the contract, but like, what actually happens when you sign a deal, and the experiences that you have with everything from signing to helping promote your book to all of that. So I'm going to be doing a presentation on that at the Royal Oaks Library next Saturday in Michigan.
Awesome. Well, cool. So all that will be in the show notes too, so people can find it, the link to where to buy your book, and go ahead and put the Etsy link in there too.
Thank you.
Maybe that, you know, every little bit helps, right? In that promotion, in that promotion category. The thing that I hate that I, you know, it's like, I just want to write books. I don't want to like flog them, but you got to.
Self-promotion is hard and icky and uncomfortable.
Yeah. It's not my favorite part of being a writer. Our last question is a tiny game of chance that I joke is because I'm a Scorpio and I don't know how to do small talk. Okay. So I will roll a die and you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Awesome.
There are very few rules to this game other than the fact that I roll a die. If you get something you don't want, you can say pass. And if I roll a 6, you get to pick which one you want.
Oh my God. Okay.
So let's see. 1, death.
Oh.
Very Scorpio topic. So I think a lot about like all of the things that different cultures have to do around death to protect themselves, to protect the dying person or the person who's recently deceased. But one of the things that I think we don't talk about as much in the community is, what does a good death look like? So what does a good death look like for you?
I'm thinking.
Light, frothy topic. So, a light, frothy topic.
Oh, wow. I think it. The only thing I can think of when I think about a good death is that I know that dying at a point in my life when I know that I'm leaving behind children that have been raised compassionately and well and will go out into the world and make a difference. And I can already say that I had like one huge goal in life, which was to put a book out that was about some kind of esoteric magical topic. And to know that I am part of that story already and part of that tapestry that goes back and back and back with all of these people, the first person who put pen to paper or stylus to clay in Sumeria to record like a blessing or a curse or whatever, being part of that just means that the good death is pretty guaranteed.
No, this is really not a light frothy talk. So
the best part about all of this is that I get to show my daughter that you can, doesn't matter how old you are, doesn't matter, you can live your dream. And she got to see it happen live in front of her very eyes.
Oh, I love that.
And, oh my God, I cry every interview. This is
I cry all the time too. Don't.
So sorry.
Don't feel bad. I'm trying really hard not to cry with you right now.
I'm never going to be satisfied. I'm never going to rest on my laurels, but I have left behind enough already. And now it's all just bonus. Mm-hmm. So I've got my good death assured.
I love
that. I feel blessed because of everything. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers the question or not. Good Lord.
No, it definitely answers the question. And thank you for being vulnerable with it. I mean, I think, you know, I always joke that none of us die with our inboxes empty. Like, that's not how this works. But I do think, now I'm going to cry too. Feeling like you've put the good thing in the world, like, you know, part of mine is like, you know, I've raised a child, like you said, who I feel like I raised compassionately and is making a difference in the world by his very existence, and gotten to publish and all of those things. And yeah, it's like, I'm not ready to go.
I've checked
a couple big things off the list, you know, like, you know, I got some stuff accomplished, but yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't think we can die with our inbox empty. I just like to not be in the middle of a book. I'd like to at least be where someone can finish it.
Yes. Actually, you said not be in the middle of a book. I'd love to go out kind of like David Bowie did, where he knew he was going out and he recorded an entire album as his like farewell. Yeah. And that man is amazing anyway, but like that just like tore me up when it happened. Mm-hmm. But it also gave me such hope that he like had his farewell message to everyone before he left. I like that idea too.
Yeah, that album is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
I feel like Leonard Cohen kind of did the same thing. I don't know if it was as deliberate as Bowie, But I feel like his last album is kind of like that too.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I like all the Leonard Cohen I've listened to, but I don't know much about him, so I'll have to check him out.
Yeah. I mean, I always feel like Leonard Cohen is one of those, like, I appreciate him so much as a writer. And I do like the stuff he records himself. But sometimes I like covers of his stuff better. Which I always feel a little guilty about saying, but like, I just think of him as such a writer's writer. Like, he's so much a writer. And then the performance is important, but almost secondary to the writing, I think, a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, Dee, thank you so much for coming on. I so enjoyed our conversation. And like I said, reading your book, and I'm excited for what you have next.
Thank you so much for having me. And this has been so much fun. And thank you for being patient with all the tears.
All good.
It's been lovely.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.